Good afternoon, everybody. If you'd like to go ahead and take your seats, we will go ahead and get started.
Once again, I forgot to blow it up.
Good afternoon. My name is Ray Pearl, and I'm the Executive Director of the California Housing Consortium. I want to thank you all for being here today as we take a look at what is going on in the housing, affordable housing world as we conclude the legislative session and as we look forward to 2015. I want to thank our co-chairs for today's event, Lynn Hutchins from Goldfarb Lippman and Jeff Brown from USA Properties. Thank you very much for helping us put this together. And of course, CHC's policy director, Marina Wyant. And I'd also like to thank Jonathan Klein, who will be here a little bit later on from Union Bank, who is our event sponsor. We have a number of panels this afternoon here to talk about things that are going on as a result of the end of the legislative session. And then we'll conclude with a panel that looks forward to next year. Again, I want to thank all of you very much for being here. I will introduce our first moderator, Lynn Hutchins, a CHC board member and partner at Goldfarb Lippman, and Matt Schwartz and Susan Riggs, if you want to join Lynn up here on the dais, she will introduce you. Thank you.
I'm still figuring out technology.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us. I'm pretty excited, actually, to be moderating this panel. When I first started in the affordable housing arena about 30 years ago, I had a bunch of binders in my office, and they had acronyms like RHCP, you know, CHIRP, 167K, accelerated depreciation, and now I get a whole new set of new binders that say things like veterans housing, AHSC, and very excited that we have some new money rolling into affordable housing after the cutbacks with redevelopment. Our panelists on our Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities program are two people who need no introduction to the affordable housing community, but I'll try anyway. To my immediate left is Susan Riggs. She is the Deputy Secretary of Housing Policy for, I need my glasses to read this agency name, Business Consumer Services and Housing Agency. Many of you know her as she was the executive director at the San Diego Federation for many years. And what many of you probably don't know is she's also the neighbor of one of my law partners. So Susan, not to be as cheesy as some insurance commercials, but it's great to have a good neighbor up here in Sacramento. Also, we have Matt Schwartz. Many of you know him as the president of the California Housing Partnership, and I think it's particularly fitting that he joins us here today. CHP has been one of the leaders in combining green building, sustainable communities, and affordable housing for quite some time. So Matt, thank you very much. The format for our workshop is Susan is going to talk about the guideline and regulation development for the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities program that's being run through the Strategic Growth Council. And then Matt is going to talk somewhat about how the Air Resources Board interacts with that. But what we really want to do And they're both going to go into the legislation and the workshops that are being run and all of that to garner input. But what we really want to do for at least the last 20 minutes of this workshop is get your reaction and input so that it can be taken back to the folks who are drafting the regulations, guidance, and policy. Okay, so with that, I'm turning it over to Susan.
Thank you. I'm going to stand because we don't have a clicker, so I'm going to click from up here, I think. Let's see. Wait. Where's...
Is it working? Okay.
So it occurs to me that folks in this room probably don't even know what the Strategic Growth Council is. I should have put a slide in, but this is going to be kind of a new endeavor, I think, for folks in the affordable housing community. So let me just spend 1 second talking about what the Strategic Growth Council is. So on the tail of AB 32, the greenhouse gas reduction legislation, and then SB 375, which is kind of the legislation that implements the land use component of that, the legislature in Schwarzenegger also created the Strategic Growth Council. And what that is basically a mini cabinet plus one public member. Right now, we're getting ready to add two additional public members. But the idea was really, in light of the coordination that was necessary in order to, kind of interagency, interpublic policy coordination that was needed to really address authentically and significantly the ability for the state to bring down greenhouse gas emissions, there needed to be better collaboration among the agencies. And so the Strategic Growth Council is comprised of the agency secretaries for California EPA, Business Consumer Services and Housing Agency, California Transportation Agency, Natural Resources, Food and Ag, and Health and Human Services. It's not like I've ever said this before. I can just rattle those off now. It's great. And then there's a public member that's appointed by the governor. And then just in the last trailer bill that created this program, there's two additional members that will be appointed, one from the Speaker of the Assembly and one from the Rules Committee in the Senate. And so so the idea really is collaboration. As you'll see, I think you'll see some things that are very reminiscent of the California Department of Housing and Community Development's Transit-Oriented Development Program and the IIG program. But we're kind of taking that as a foundation and really kind of trying to integrate and demonstrate a broader span, a broader scope of public policy components into the program. So you'll kind of see that through my presentation. So affordable housing and sustainable communities program, that's what we're talking about today. So this is the cap and trade program, the greenhouse gas reduction fund program that's going to specifically address some of our land use issues, our affordable housing needs. And so today I'm just going to go through quickly the existing laws and mandates that are connected to this just to kind of give you guys some context because, a lot of our guideline development is already framed in the statute and some of the related laws. Provide you some information about the program timeline and concurrent processes that are really important in terms of how this comes together. Proposed program concepts, and then, at the end, as you heard, we'll be kind of getting input or, hopefully I'm getting some input from you guys on what you're looking for. So let me start with the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, and I think everybody knows this is cap and trade, but we've been told not to call it cap and trade, so it's the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. A whole range of programs were adopted through SB 832, which was the budget trailer bill related to the revenues that were being created through the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, $832 million for this year. Across a bunch of different programs, $130 million of that is dedicated to the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Program. That's this year's allocation. We have a continuing appropriation after this year at 20% of the overall revenues for the cap and trade program, the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund program, 10% of which will be dedicated to affordable housing purposes. As you probably are aware, if you track the legislature, the continuing appropriation is only as good as the next legislative session. So, you know, just keep that in mind. We want to make sure that we're demonstrating that this is a very effective and, you know, successful program in the first year, especially. One other thing I'll just mention about this slide, you'll see, you know, a whole range of other programs that are being administered by other partners that sit on the Strategic Growth Council. And one of the things that we're working really hard to do is to figure out ways we can align and leverage those programs, because we recognize, you know, in many cases, you know, we hear, you know, from various communities that we'd like to see bus passes attached to affordable housing, you know, adjacent to transit. And, you know, there's a range of programs, you know, that are being funded through the overall Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. And so, you know, we really think it's important, you know, all needs don't necessarily have to be met out of this program, but we like to think comprehensively, and maybe there's ways to align, you know, these other programs around, you know, with, you know, energy efficiency and all the things that we'd like to see in our communities, but use other funds strategically. So key laws on greenhouse gas reduction. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this because I've already mentioned AB 32 and SB 375, and then I'm going to go in to more depth on some of these other ones in just a moment. I think I mentioned SB 862 is the 2014 bill that created the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund program. So. Okay, so really key to the entire process, this is kind of getting to the concurrent processes that really affect the implementation of what we're doing, are two concurrent processes that are coming through the Air Resources Board. You know, all of this is cap and trade. The entire purpose of the program, of all of the funds that were on that previous slide, is to reduce greenhouse gases. And so that's the context for everything, and that's why the Air Resources Board is really actively involved here. And so they have two key roles. One is really helping to set up the metrics and monitoring for the projects and activities that are being funded through any of the programs. And number two, you may have heard of SB 535 or some conversation about disadvantaged communities. That's a really significant piece of our program. Overall, the requirements for all of the cap and trade revenues is that 10% of the funds be invested in disadvantaged communities. And Matt is going to go into more specifically what exactly those are and how that's being defined in just a moment. And then 25% have to be invested, of the funds have to be invested in a way that benefit disadvantaged communities. And one of the key pieces right now is we're figuring out what benefits means, and that's a really important determination for us, especially because those are the program-wide, the entire, you know, through all the programs, those are the requirements. In our program, the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Program, the requirement is that 50% of the funds be invested in a way that benefit disadvantaged communities. And so we've got, you know, we have two overlays. One is 50% of the revenues are going to be invested for affordable housing, and 50% are going to be invested in a way that benefit disadvantaged communities. Those can overlap. Those can be, you know, those are not mutually exclusive realms. So you can have affordable housing that's benefiting disadvantaged communities and vice versa. So, but those are two big overlays that we have to be cognizant of. So the interim guidance on disadvantaged communities just came out. Again, the purpose is to provide, you know, in part, a definition of what it means to benefit disadvantaged communities. And so there's initial guidance out right now. I think Matt's going to talk about that in more depth, and so I won't go much into that. There were just a series of public workshops, and I think ARB is still, you know, seeking input. And then on September 18th is a really key date. That's when the Air Resources Board is slated to approve the draft guidelines for that. And so that's a really key date. And obviously, I can't emphasize enough the importance of what gets adopted there, because whatever benefits disadvantaged communities means, that really is very instructive in terms of how we are designing our program. So very, very important. And that's, you know, a concurrent process that's happening. The other piece is the metrics and, you know, the monitoring of the projects and investments, and here's the timeline for that. And so what this is, as we move forward in constructing and designing our program, we have to be very cognizant of what ARB is going to be asking us to demonstrate through the investments. And we don't know that yet, as you see in the timeline. I mean, we're talking, you know, October through 2015, where we're going to be getting that guidance. We're going to be relying on some interim guidance initially. But the final guidelines aren't going to be adopted until 2015, probably right around the time we're adopting our final, or actually after we put out our NOFA for funds. So this is going to be a very, very important process as well. There are wide-reaching implications here. Do we, you know, measure on a per-project basis? Do we measure based upon different components of activities, you know, whether it's affordable housing at TOD or, you know, so there's a lot of questions that still are out there, and that's all being developed again through the Air Resources Board. Okay, so kind of to give you a sense of kind of the process, the key piece is greenhouse gas reduction, and it's all flowing from this greenhouse gas reduction fund. Air Resources Board is providing a lot of guidance to us, on disadvantaged communities, how we're going to measure the GHG reduction, and then also a third component is really co-benefits. And so again, you know, this is the idea being that, you know, we're working collaboratively across agencies, across public policy, and so we've got to demonstrate co-benefits. So the Strategic Growth Council is the primary administrator of the entire program, of the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Program. There are two administrative partners, one of which is the Department of Housing and Community Development that's going to be working very, very closely to administer and implement the program on the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Community side. And then there's a complementary piece that's really about ag preservation that was part of the legislation as well. The idea being it's kind of the flip side of the coin from kind of the urban infill, TOD scenario, that we also, at the same time that we're creating compact development, urban development patterns, we want to make sure that we're protecting the fringe, you know, along urban areas, and making sure that we're not gobbling up more and more rural areas. So that's a smaller piece that's actually going to be administered by the Department of Natural Resources. All right, so let's dive into the program, and I'm going to speed it up a little bit because I know I'm probably already running over. I've already said demonstrate GHG reductions. Another requirement is state planning priorities. These are not anything that are completely outside the box. These are, you know, things like creating compact infill opportunities and typical things, reducing vehicle miles traveled and that sort of thing. So this is all things that we'll be trying to accomplish anyway. We have to be consistent with the sustainable community strategies in each of the regions, and so this is kind of a new thing where, you know, the MPOs, the Metropolitan Planning Organizations, in the various regions are going to be a significant new partner as we, you know, begin to review applications and award applicants funding through this program. And so, you know, we're in discussions right now with the MPOs to kind of decide what role they play. But, you know, the legislation clearly tells us that, you know, the intent is, because the Metropolitan Planning Organizations are really the primary vehicle for reducing GHGs at the regional levels, they really have to be a significant partner at the table as we're investing in particular projects and activities on the ground. I already mentioned disadvantaged communities, affordable housing. So this is probably not going to be at all novel to you guys, having all probably been very familiar with the HCD's TOD program. The idea is really, you know, making connections. This is, you know, the SB 375 stuff where we're really trying to make connections between, work and housing and educational opportunities and all of those types of things through non-traditional transportation methods that help us to bring down vehicle miles traveled, which in turn translates into reduction of GHGs. And there's a variety of ways to do this. And let me just interject here that, you know, California Housing Partnership Corporation has been a fantastic partner with the state in bringing forward information on how affordable housing at TOD helps to reduce VMT and greenhouse gases, but also now is doing a study to help us work through the question of, does that model also fit in suburban and rural areas? Because we recognize that we're not going to solve this problem just by investing in urban areas. We also, you know, really want to see some more geographic diversity through this program. So we all appreciate the partnership that CHPIC has demonstrated. Eligible uses, so this is, again, this is statutory, so this is not anything that we're, you know, there's no policy work being done here. Affordable housing, transit, active transportation, complete streets. And you'll see, I mean, you know, these are very specifically defined activities that are representing kind of a broader range of activities than we've seen in some of the other programs. And we'll be funding through both loans and grants, depending on the type of use that is being funded. So GHG reductions, this kind of goes back to, you know, how we're going to demonstrate and the metrics and measurements we're going to use to demonstrate GHG reductions. You know, there are a range of things, including, as I've mentioned, reduction in vehicle miles traveled, but also, you know, improved energy efficiency. You know, there's a whole range of things that we may be looking at, and we're trying to think very creatively about, you know, where the nexus lies between, you know, the activities that we can fund and how we can bring down GHGs. So, and those are, you know, those are, I think, the universe of what we might be contemplating probably hasn't even been anticipated yet, and so that's a place where we're really, in particular, looking for feedback from you guys. This is kind of just a concept summary of kind of the way we've been thinking about it. Projects will increase accessibility of housing, employment centers, and key destinations via low-carbon transportation options, resulting in fewer vehicle miles traveled. So I think you guys have gotten that point. And so this really kind of gets to, you know, kind of the range of project options. I mean, there's a lot of different pieces that we could put together. I mean, one of the things we've been thinking about is, you know, I know the affordable housing community has been working really hard to see, you know, for example, how we can maximize the use of new market tax credits. Well, you know, because there's going to be a broader range of eligible uses in these projects. I mean, maybe there's a way to marry in new ways, you know, different funding sources that haven't been super accessible to us in the past. And so, you know, so you see a range of different options here where there's like integrated non-housing projects, you know, infill, mixed use, mixed income projects. And so I think, you know, we're really thinking very differently about the types of projects that can be funded, all the while knowing that 50% of the funding is going to be dedicated to affordable housing. Just to kind of distinguish for a second the scale and the kind of the scope of this program versus the transit-oriented development program, you know, I think in the TOD program, I mean, it was really pretty site-specific what we were looking to fund, and we're really looking a little bit more globally now at the types of projects. It may not be that we're funding all aspects of the project, and probably won't, given it's only $130 million in the first year. But really looking to try and make the connections. How does a particular activity, a particular project fit in the community context? How is it addressing holistically the ability to reduce greenhouse gases, reduce VMT, those types of things? And so it's a little bit different context in that we really want to see how the project fits into the broader community. I think you guys are probably all familiar with these. These were TOD examples, 1050 B Street in San Diego, MacArthur Park in Los Angeles, MacArthur Transit Station in Oakland, and Union City Intermodal in Union City. And so these are great examples of, you know, kind of the projects that were funded through the IIG and TOD programs that, you know, are really kind of models that we'd like to kind of use to kind of explore how we can even better integrate different project components. I mentioned co-benefits earlier. This is, you know, one of the other mandates that we're going to have to achieve is to demonstrate, you know, how what we're funding achieves multiple co-benefits. And so this is kind of a list of the co-benefits that are being anticipated, you know, things like, you know, supporting economic growth, workforce development, creating civic partnerships. I think we're really anticipating in terms of the applicant types that it will be a really integrated approach where, you know, our applicants aren't necessarily, I mean, there's a single lead applicant, but maybe that lead applicant has, you know, is working together with, you know, their transit advocates and their public health advocates and, you know, maybe the local jurisdiction or whatever to really kind of have, you know, cross public policy partnerships. You know, I mentioned the importance of the implementation of the sustainable community strategies and the work that we're going to be doing with the metropolitan planning organizations. This is just the statutory provision that, you know, that we are guided by, as that we're required to support the project investments are required to support implementation of an adopted or draft sustainable community strategy, and that we have to coordinate with the MPO. So that's just solidifying that. So in closing, almost closing, these are the key questions that we're asking. How are we reducing GHGs? How are we benefiting disadvantaged communities? How are we providing affordable housing? And how are we providing those co-benefits that were on the prior slide? And then, in closing, most importantly, the timeline. So this is our draft timeline right now. We just finished our initial round of workshops. We're going to be releasing draft guidelines on in the beginning of September. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the date right now, but in time for an October 6th Strategic Growth Council meeting. And so we'll have those 10 days ahead, so whatever that is, of the October 6th Strategic Growth Council meeting. That's an opportunity for folks to give initial feedback. But just on the heels of that, we'll be having another round of public workshops, hopefully have them in a little bit different locations so that folks that didn't get to make the first round will be able to participate in the second round. So that'll be throughout October. We're looking to release the final draft guidelines in November and then take the final to the Strategic Growth Council for adoption in December. And then, most importantly, the NOFA hopefully will be released in January. And then by June, we're hoping to have awards announced. So that's probably one of the most important slides. So I wanted to end with that. I think that is my last slide. Great, thank you.
For those who are wondering, the PowerPoint slides will be posted at the CHC website if you want to download them later.
Hello, everyone. I'm going to take on the role of the agent provocateur here today. I know that will surprise many of you in the room who know me. But I'm going to try to put out some, in addition to shedding a little bit more light about disadvantaged communities, which is kind of a newish concept for a lot of us in the housing community to think about, I'm going to try to put out some straw proposals for the way that the state might consider allocating some of at least the housing portion of the Affordable Housing Sustainable Communities funds, because I think it's a conversation that's going to take a while and that we need to start having. So I'm going to start by quickly, I'm not going to go through these slides because Susan already has and did a much better job than I can do. I just want to remind us of this part here, because this again is foreign to most of us as affordable housers. In general, disadvantaged communities are going to receive a large portion of cap and trade revenues in terms of benefiting them. And in particular, in this program, the Affordable Housing Sustainable Communities Program, at least 50% of the funds must benefit them. So I know, I was a project manager, some of you know this, for many years. I think like a developer still, at least with half of my brain. And I know that many of us in our community might like to just find a way to get by disadvantaged communities and just make this another affordable housing funding program. It won't work. It can't. This mandate is too big. So that's just a point I want you to hold on to as we go through this. So what are disadvantaged communities? This is really an open question. There isn't a firm answer yet, but I want to just show a few of the considerations that are being discussed by state agencies. You see two columns there. On the left, pollution burdens, which is part of the law to consider, and you can see different ones there. And on the right, population characteristics, which are a little more familiar to some people in the affordable housing field who've worked on designing affordable housing programs, things that we think about, poverty and unemployment and connections to health services, et cetera. And then on the right, you see something called the Cal EnviroScreen Score, which is a tool that's been developed by Cal EPA to try to help us synthesize these different criteria. So here's what a map of California looks like using at least one version of this scoring criteria. The deepest red would be the highest scores for disadvantaged communities, the top 10%. And a straw proposal is on the table that those would be defined as the disadvantaged communities, those top 10%, the red. It's also possible that the next level down of kind of orange might also receive a priority. Before I show you a couple of quick snapshots of regional maps, I just want to make the point. The law says disadvantaged communities must be benefited. It does not say that developments must be in disadvantaged communities. And this is a really critical point. So when you look at these next maps, there are people who want all the money to be spent in these red zones around the state. But there are also people who are part of the advocacy group that really fought for and won the disadvantaged communities provisions. It was called the 535 Coalition after SB 535, which is Speaker-elect De Leon's bill. There are people there who say, wait a second, the whole goal was not to develop and put all the resources there, it's to make sure those communities are benefited because of these impacts. So hold that thought. I'm just going to quickly show you maps which you can find on the Cal EPA website, but it really varies a lot by region because of the census tract approach that they've taken. They initially took a zip code approach, which had some very different results. It seems the census tract approach is the way that they're going to proceed. So here's a quick view of Sacramento, the areas that must be benefited in dark red, possibly deep orange. Los Angeles Inland Empire area. And you can begin to see that it's not just about high poverty. It really is a lot about pollution impacts. Bay Area, there's some folks in the Bay Area who are not happy about the switch to the census tracts because, as you can see, there's not a whole lot of red there. Close up of East Bay and San Francisco, if any of you are from that region. All right, so let's talk a little bit about some of the tensions here. And I apologize for too much writing on this slide. I should have broken it into two pieces. So we've talked about the different factors in bullet one that go into the top 10% determination. And the second bullet really just makes that point that for disadvantaged people living in disadvantaged communities to really benefit, the main thing is that the investments emphasize connections to transit, jobs, services, health, education, and that they're not going to be in close proximity to pollution or basically moving people away from environmental hazards. The third major bullet is just a transition point here. Some of you may have heard this expression, communities of opportunity. It's come primarily from the fair housing community, which is deeply concerned that investments in low-income housing, among other types of investments, have concentrated poverty in low-income census tracts. And there is a reason to be concerned about it. There's also a reason not to redline these areas, as some extreme fair housing advocates would like to do. The next bullet just acknowledges that HUD made a major sea change. I don't know how many of you paid attention to this. When they published Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing, their new rule, which speaks to this very issue, which says that when you make investments of federal or state funds, you must try to make sure that you're providing access to low-income people to communities of opportunity. What does that mean? It means communities with good schools, low crime, good transit, and good housing in good condition. So I note this because some forces are aligning here from a federal level to a state level. And again, these are forces I think we ignore at our own peril. So how are disadvantaged communities getting defined? So the ARB, as Susan said, has the major role. And you can see that at least one cut at this would be you have to meet at least one of the following criteria from this list. So be within a radius, not necessarily in the disadvantaged community, but be within a radius of it, and reduce VMT, and avoid displacement, or contribute to basically employment outcomes for people in those districts. The Cal EPA also has a major role here, working with ARB, and they are experimenting with different matrices, and the two I've listed are the two that I believe they're leaning towards out of four that they're exploring. But again, there's more information about this on their website, and I don't have time to get into all of it today. So here's the part where I start to be provocative. I want us to start thinking about how do we help disadvantaged communities? How do we honor both the spirit and the law while also building more affordable housing that is clearly also asked for in this legislation? And so one way is to think about something that fair housing advocates so often used against us or argued against, which is occupancy preferences. I don't know about the rest of you, but when I was a developer in the Peninsula area in the 90s, we used occupancy preferences a lot. It's how we got communities, high-income communities of opportunity like Los Gatos or Palo Alto, for example, to grudgingly say yes to siting low-income housing, because we told them that people, low-income workers in their communities, would receive a first preference. After a period of time, we started getting challenged on using those preferences because they ended up, in some cases, statistically discriminating against protected classes. So they fell out of favor. Some of you may still be using them in different contexts. But here's a context where they may be able to be used to our advantage. And that is, if we can conceive of having an occupancy preference for people living in or possibly adjacent to, within a half mile radius of, disadvantaged communities, who would then gain access to housing funded, in part at least, by this new program. Am I suggesting they receive 100% preference? No. But some percentage of the units, perhaps in relationship to the amount of funding coming from this program, could be allocated on a first preference basis to residents from these areas. So hold that thought for a minute. And you can come back and tell me why you think it won't work or whether you have questions or thoughts about it. A second idea is we're starting with a small amount of money. There could be as little as $65 million in this year, which feels like a huge victory on the one hand, but let's be real. That's not going to fund a full statewide program with allocations to 12 or more regions, which, just to use the tax credit analogy, could be required. But it's a down payment. We're looking at $200 to $300 million, maybe more per year through 2020. It's possible that funding could even be combined in a couple of cycles. So we may get to the point where a statewide funding system is actually feasible, and I think we need to think about one, because one of the criteria is going to be leveraging other funds. And those of us in this room know that leveraging the low-income housing tax credit is really critical if you're going to talk about leveraging funding in most cases. So here are some straw principles of designing a new program. Maximize leverage, which we all know how to do, particularly the low-income housing tax credit where it's appropriate. One thing that we have to also do is the first sub-bullet. Senator Steinberg made it clear in his remarks, and I know the Strategic Growth Council has embraced this, Susan mentioned this, rural areas and smaller cities cannot be ignored in this process. If they are, it's at our peril, because there are legislators in those districts who are watching this program very carefully. And it doesn't mean that there should be just a kind of a block grant approach to give every community some small amount of money. That would not honor either the letter or the spirit of the law. But it means that there has to be some form of rural access, even though rural communities can't compete in reducing VMTs, generally speaking, with urbanized areas. So there may need to be a set aside of some kind, as there is in the tax credit program. Second bullet. Allocations of this new funding in this proposed principle should be timed so that they work in conjunction with tax credits. 9%, 4% is up for discussion. We need to move closer to, and I believe it's people's interest in this administration, move closer to something resembling a one-stop shop approach to try to minimize the risks that developers constantly are taking in trying to get one piece of the funding puzzle without having the others in shape. Two, we can't ignore reducing vehicle miles traveled. If we do, the state and the whole program becomes vulnerable to legal challenge, becomes vulnerable to political challenges. So we have to use proven methods of demonstrating VMT reduction. We published, along with Transform and the Center for Neighborhood Technology, a study that some of you saw that showed how to reduce VMTs using HCD's TOD areas and SB 375 sustainable communities areas in June. Actually, it was late May. That is one way to get to VMT reduction. It is not the only way. As Susan mentioned, we're working with Rural Smart Growth Advocates and Center for Neighborhood Technology again. We think we can come up with a formula that would predict significant reductions in vehicle miles traveled for pretty much every part of the state that is near, not necessarily transit, but at least some crucial amenities that generate trips, schools, employment centers, health centers. So we're working on that. We hope to be able to provide the Strategic Growth Council with some models that they could use, working with HCD in developing some criteria. But we can't ignore VMT reduction. Lastly, on this list at least, as I said, we cannot ignore how we benefit disadvantaged communities. Some of you may want to argue that the money should go to developing in those 10% of zones or maybe 20% of zones. I personally think that we will split the state if we do that, and it's not because I happen to live in San Francisco. I think most of you know we have an office in Los Angeles. We work statewide. I think it's because we will split the state if only some census tracts end up benefiting. And I also think it will violate fair housing principles that are now ensconced in federal and state law. And I think it will not necessarily be the solution embraced by the very coalition that put this portion of the law in play, who we're talking to regularly and we're going to continue talking to. The last thing I want to say before turning it over to all of you to comment on, if that's going to be part of the program, is that I think most of you know Megan Kirkby, my colleague. Megan, if you could hold up your hand. Megan is going to be traveling around the state and doing 5 workshops just for affordable housing stakeholders and your allies with a number of other folks hosted by regional associations, including NPH. I see Michael next to Megan. And I hope all of you who are here today and your colleagues will come attend those, because that's where a lot of input is going to be given to our community, where we figure out what it is that we want. And I hope we can try to speak with as close to one voice as possible, because we'll be a lot more effective than if we start lobbying Susan and her colleagues in HCD in 12 different directions, which occasionally happens. I will leave it there. Back to you, Lynn.
Thank you, Matt. First of all, does anyone have questions they'd like to ask of Matt or Susan before we move on to comments? Nope. Yes, John.
I think Susan would actually be best positioned.
Let's repeat the question.
Yeah, the $130 million is the entire bucket for this year, and 50% of that is dedicated for affordable housing, so just split it in half. Yeah.
But, Susan, it is possible that more than $65 million might end up being invested in affordable housing.
Yeah, that's the minimum, is 50%. And then going forward, it will be, assuming that the continuous appropriation stays in place, it'll be 20% is the entire bucket for the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Program, and then 50% of that will be dedicated for affordable housing purposes.
Any other questions? Yes, in the back.
Yeah.
Yeah, so so the question had to do with, as the guidelines for the program are coming out, is there also going to be some guidance on the VMT reduction piece of it? That's a softball question. Thank you. So this is where it gets tricky and why I was emphasizing all the Air Resources Board, you know, concurrent processes. So really the measurements that are, you know, VMT related, that demonstrate the GHG reduction, those are all coming from the Air Resources Board. And so we're kind of flying with one wing right now, because the timeline for those measurements and metrics for us to use aren't going to be finalized probably until June 2015. And if you remember our timeline, we're hoping to be awarding by June 2015. And so we're going to be relying on some interim guidance that's going to come out hopefully in October from the Air Resources Board. It's what we're being told by them is, and we're working very closely with them, is that we can rely on that interim guidance for this year. And it may or may not change, you know, in June when the final guidance comes out, but at least for purposes of this funding round, we'll rely on the interim guidance. But because we haven't even gotten the interim guidance yet, we don't know what that looks like. So, and that's why, you know, I really wanted to emphasize those processes, because that's going to impact ultimately the program pretty substantially.
For those who are wondering, there are draft guidelines from the ARB, and you can go to their website and download them and all their wonder and splendor.
I think that this one's for the disadvantaged communities.
It's for the disadvantaged communities, yes. But it doesn't have any VMT information yet.
So let me just clarify that. So there's two separate sets of guidance. So what Lynn is referring to is specific to the disadvantaged communities. So that's the 535 stuff. I know this gets very convoluted, which is why I put the list of laws to begin with. And then there's SB 1018, and that is the metrics. So the initial guidance is out for the disadvantaged communities, and so we have something to reflect on and get feedback on, and then hopefully those are going to be finaled in September. Then ARB will turn to the metrics piece, and so we'll have some interim guidance, hopefully published by October. So we don't have anything to reflect on yet on the 1018 piece.
There's a question over here. Yes. I think what you said, is there an expectation when the money is awarded through HCD, it will be based on their current UMRs? Uniform multifamily regulations.
I don't think we're there yet. So we're just in the process of putting together the draft guidelines that, as I mentioned, there's going to be a whole, you know, series of public workshops on that. And so at this point, you know, I think a lot of folks have really imagined that, you know, although we're doing the public workshops and kind of going through, you know, a public process, that somehow we've really already had the draft guidelines written. Well, we haven't. I mean, we really are making a really authentic attempt to rethink the entire thing. So at this point, there aren't any presumptions on what's going to be included and what's not. I think, you know, from the housing standpoint, however, knowing that they're not written yet and they certainly have not been published yet, it will look much like the TOD program on the housing side, just because, you know, the housing expertise obviously is within HCD. So I hope that's helpful.
Are there other questions? Yes, up front. Did folks hear that comment? Her comment was that in terms of looking at rent and reducing VMTs and combining housing, we really need to focus on separating rent for the housing versus the cost of the parking space in an attempt to reduce folks' use and dependence on cars. Any response? Okay. All right.
I have a list of questions, but I'm thinking maybe looking at Matt's design principles here, it might be most beneficial if people could react to any of his suggestions, either positively or negatively or with another idea. Any ideas? How about, you know, I've heard of a lot of concerns about replicating the TCAC program, although I have to say there's some efficiencies with that. And how do people feel about regional allocations? Everybody, it's after lunch and it's hot, so everybody wants to take a nap. Go right ahead. Kristen, yes.
And if I can just respond to that just a little bit, just to kind of, you know. Oh, so here, you want to repeat Kristen's? Yeah. So I think Kristen's point was really just, you know, trying to balance the amount of money with the distribution methodology and just making sure that we're not spreading the peanut butter too thin. Is that an accurate? Sorry, I'm no. Yeah. Yeah, so just making sure that, you know, there's kind of a balance there, and that's something we're cognizant of as well. I think the only thing that I would flag here is the TCAC geographic apportionment is based upon, you know, kind of broader regions than we would have to consider. If you remember in my presentation, I talked a lot about the metropolitan planning organizations. This is new for us. I mean, we're used to the TCAC methodology for distribution, but those don't really match the MPOs, and it's the MPOs that we are required to coordinate with. Again, and I'll just emphasize this just so that you understand, this is not, I mean, you know, in a way we kind of feel like we're recreating the wheel, and why wouldn't we just go with TCAC? But it's really because when the legislation SB 375 was written, that the onus to demonstrate regionally how the each of the regions were going to reduce greenhouse gases comes down to the MPOs, to the metropolitan planning organizations. And so they're a natural partner. So they're the ones who are, you know, through SB 375, we're aligning our transportation planning processes with the housing element process and really trying to make the connections between housing and transportation. And through that, we're really, the regions were required, these MPOs were required to articulate how their planning strategies were going to result in the reduction of GHGs and, you know, and reduction of VMT. And so they're really the partner. And so to kind of take the TCAC model and lay it on top of then, how does that fit within our partnership with the MPO, it's a difficult kind of correlation. So that's the only thing I would say there, is that we have to keep in mind that, I mean, we have a mandate to work with the MPOs, and it makes sense because of what their obligations are under SB 375.
I saw another hand up. Yes, Ray? Or no, sorry. Aaron. In the back, Aaron, sorry.
Sorry, I can't let a question go by without responding. Sorry. So this is a little bit apart from what we're talking about today, but I'm sure probably everyone knows that we have newly appointed HCD directors and CalHFA directors. We're really excited to have the leadership team in place. And, you know, I think, you know, Tia in particular is really excited about, you know, kind of having some conversations about, you know, how we can better align some of our funding processes and that sort of thing. And so, you know, kind of, you know, I think we're trying to think holistically about how to better align. I mean, given, you know, fewer resources, we want to make each dollar go further, stretch further, and, you know, the best way to do that is to try and simplify the intake process. And so, you know, I think with both these funds and kind of holistically, we're trying to think through that.
I think if you consider geographic proportionality,
Okay, just because folks are having a hard time hearing with the fans. Her point was the disadvantaged communities don't necessarily align with the TCAC regional setting, so we'd have to think that through a little bit. And then you had another comment.
Just a quick response, Kara, on that one. If you're going to be literal, if someone is taking a literal approach, you're absolutely right. But I guess I'm suggesting, is that in the best interests of the people in the disadvantaged communities, that they have to be stick in even the regions in the same metropolitan planning organizations, or is there a way to give them more choice and give them access to communities of opportunities potentially across the state if they're willing to move? So I can see why you'd make that point, but I'm not sure it has to be true. So that's a fair point to say that how can we be sure people would be willing to move, and maybe you should look at proximity. But why should we make that choice for people? Why not give people a chance to go all over, and they may end up wanting to stick closer to where they are. But why should we make that choice for them? I guess that's my counterpoint. Why not give them a choice?
Is there another hand? Okay. How do people feel about the word benefit that's in the statute? How would you like to see that defined? I know that's not really our prerogative here. It occurs to me that that's kind of a loaded word. Is the benefit only going to be measured by VMT reduction or greenhouse gas reduction, or is it going to be measured by other criteria? And if so, what would you like folks to be considering as they consider the guidelines? Any ideas? So she was commenting that we also need to consider job creation and kind of a local community benefit, maybe a way of using your underutilized non-residential housing spaces in your mixed projects. Any other ideas about benefit and what you'd like the guidelines to reflect? Not hearing affordability.
Okay. So if you could combine a new project that creates jobs, housing, reduces greenhouse gas, and also remediates the soil or the water in the vicinity as well. Any other ideas? Oh, let's see. In the back of the room.
So I think the question was, you know, what kind of defining the communities versus how to measure long term? Is that kind of the essence of it? Yeah, so kind of the factors and criteria that are used in determining what the disadvantaged communities are, those same factors should be used to demonstrate whether or not the conditions are improving. Yeah. So I've heard a couple of things that make me want to just kind of clarify. I think somebody had said the program requires that 50% of the funds be invested in disadvantaged communities. I think somebody said that. I want to just reiterate again, there's two pieces that we're talking about. One is investment in, and so the CalEnvirus screen that Matt showed with those red areas, those are the actual disadvantaged communities. And so that's the first tier. Program-wide, for all the greenhouse gas investment fund investments, 10% has to be in there. Our program, the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Program, which is a subset of the entire Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, isn't directly statutorily required to invest anything in disadvantaged communities in those areas. My guess is we will, and we may even put it into our program guidelines, but statutorily we're not required to invest anywhere there. What we're required to do is kind of the second tier, which is benefits disadvantaged communities. And that's where I think Matt was trying to emphasize, you know, kind of the rubs and the tension with benefits and what Lynn was saying, you know, how do you feel about the word benefits? Because it's, you know, right now it's wide open. And so program-wide, Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, 25% of the funds have to be invested in a way that benefit disadvantaged communities. And so in my mind, and you know, I'm certainly not in the mind of the Air Resources Board because they're a bunch of scientists and, you know, engineers and people that are not like me. So I don't know how they're going to define benefits, but in my mind it's been, you know, the difference between a disadvantaged community being a geographic area, you know, being very defined by the red on the map, versus a population that's being served. Because when you talk about benefits, theoretically it could be, and probably will be, outside of those red areas, but somehow the population that is considered to be disadvantaged is being served. And so maybe it's the population that's living there that we're, as Matt suggests, maybe we're providing them some choices to move out of disadvantaged communities, out of the red areas. You know, perhaps it's, you know, work opportunities, workforce development, you know, that is serving specifically the population that is living in the red areas. So the benefits piece is really, really important, especially for our program, because 50% of the revenue we have to be able to demonstrate is being invested in a way that benefits disadvantaged communities. And so that word benefits right now is, we're putting an enormous amount of weight on that, because how we define that is really going to impact our program design. And so I just want to reemphasize that, you know, that the difference between the red areas and benefits the red areas is something that is a question that's open right now. There's some draft guidelines, but there's still an opportunity to really think through the range of opportunities that we have as we invest, as we invest this money to benefit the population. I think of it as the population that is disadvantaged. So.
All right, we've got about 5 minutes. So I saw another hand here, Jeff, and then one over here.
So right over here, please. Oh, Kristen.
I could just quickly try to summarize Kristen's two points. One, as one local government would weigh in favor of not forcing the benefits to go into the areas that already have concentrated poverty, the top 10%. And the second one is it's easily quantifiable what the rent benefit is below market in an affordable housing development. So that seems like a good safe harbor to focus on. I would just add to that, to make it work for the law, you have to show that the people in disadvantaged communities have access to that. And that's where, again, an idea like an occupancy preference could establish that nexus. And even if a household chooses not to move in to that unit, they had access, and that could be a benefit.
Yeah, especially since HCD says you can't have preferences on their programs. There was another comment on this side.
We're out of time, so I don't know. We're past time, so if you want to take it.
Go ahead. We're okay for two.
The only thing I would offer is that with regard to these benefits, it might be very nice for developers to sort of have, okay, if you're in a disadvantaged community and you're next to a school or something like that, it does clear cut.
So for those who couldn't hear, he was talking about having a simple kind of scoring mechanism, maybe with multiple tiers. One, if you're located near a school or something like that, that would be an automatic, tier, and then one where you can tell a different story depending on your situation. Over here, you had a comment, and then Jeff.
Oh, really? Matt, take it away.
Thanks, Lynn. I owe you one. Well, clearly, I'm not the regulator in charge of making this, but I think, it's clear that in determining the disadvantaged communities, health has been considered. So if the people living in districts with the top scores who have, look in that top right-hand box in particular, have those health issues, and we are be able to provide them with safe, decent housing that, and service, perhaps linkages to services and better linkages to hospitals or healthcare clinics, that seems like a direct way to address health. And I think it's a really important one that also ties into other trends in the Affordable Care Act.
Okay, so we really have run out of time, so I'm going to cut my co-chair off here, and he'll have to save his comment for later. But can we thank Matt and Susan for giving a really interesting presentation, and all of you for commenting.